weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to you, Johnny's. It's Thursday, the 28th of September, and this is Game On. Well, coming up today, the opening ceremony is done and dusted. So Greg Allen reports from the Ryder Cup in Rome. Irish eyes are fully focused on the Scotland game at the Rugby World Cup. Neil Tracy will bring us the latest from the Irish camp. Plus, Keith Tracy on Andrew Moran's heroics for Blackburn, and Jeff Shepherd on Taylor and Travis. If you know, you know. And if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. If you've been listening for the week, you know that we've had a competition every day so far. And if you would like to join in on the club and experience the world's game on another level, then listen closely. Tomorrow, September 29th, EA Sports FC launches the highly anticipated FC 24. Yes, EA Sports FC 24 will showcase the best players from the biggest clubs, leagues and competitions around the globe in both the men's and women's game for ultimate inclusion and authenticity in game. EA Sports FC C24 launches across PlayStation 5, 4, Xbox, PC and Switch. And to celebrate, we have a copy to give away every day this week, thanks to EA Sports. To be with the chance to win, all you have to do is answer the following question. Which nation won the 2022 FIFA World Cup Final? Text your answer, name, email address and county to 51552. And as always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details. Welcome along, and we are going to start with rugby today because the World Cup is very much in focus with games on all of the time, but eyes are very much turning to that Scotland game next weekend. So Simon Easterby was out talking to the media today and he said that all of the Ireland squad are fit and training.
After a few days of recovery, lads have come back in good spirits and yeah, everyone was out there today, all 33. I think it was always the plan to have that little break with the way the schedule set out. So I think it was good timing for us, spend a bit of time with our families and coming back in, everyone's in good spirits. And Stu McCloskey's got to become a dad for a second time as well, which is great. So yeah, it's all good news. Jack is a really important part of the squad. He's good around the group. At certain stages, he's probably felt it might not come right, but he's worked really hard with the conditioners, with the physios, with nutritionists. He's done everything he can to get himself in this position. And I guess we've been fortunate with injuries in his position as well that we haven't had to call upon him. So a number of things have aligned to allow Jack to get himself right. And I think it was definitely the right thing for us to have him and give him the opportunity. And I think we're starting to see, you know, the Jack that we'd like to have seen a few weeks ago, but obviously injury has not allowed him to be in that place. So he's in a good place and no reason why he won't be available next week.
And what are the main areas you take away from the South African game to focus on?
I think, you know, things that we could get better. Our discipline near the end, you know, almost let them back in to have an opportunity to go and get a 5 metre drive and probably couple of penalties which are avoidable. So those are the sort of things we talk about a lot, but it's important that we stay on point and make sure that we don't give sides like South Africa the chance. Our maul defence at the end was excellent and put the game to bed. But you know, there's those sorts of things that you want to make sure in the last 20 minutes you're on the front foot. We did well to get up the other end and we got a scrum penalty to get the 3 points to take us to 5 points ahead. But I think we also gave them a little bit of a window to get back into our 22 and give them an opportunity to get some access at the end. So that's certainly an area that we need to make sure we stay on top of when we're building up to Scotland. Listen, Scotland are a brilliant team. They have the ability to play lots of different ways. They can mix it up front with their forward pack, strong maul, scrum, as we saw against South Africa, but they can also play an expansive game with some exciting backs that can really hurt you if you're not on it. So listen, there's definitely no lack of focus for us. Like I say, we always plan to have that few days off, regardless of what the result was against Africa, and we knew that this final game of the pool would be pivotal.
That was Simon Easterby speaking to the media a little bit earlier on, and one of those present was Neil Tracy, and he joins us now on the line. How are you, Neil?
I'm very well, Marie. How are you?
So where are you now? What's the setup?
The setup is where the media, we're still out in tour. Well, I say still, I arrived yesterday, but there's a handful who are, I think, getting cabin fever at this stage, who've been out since the start of September.
Sure.
But yeah, it's in tour about about an hour and a half outside Paris on the train. So this is where Ireland have been based since the start of the World Cup and will be based up until the end of the pool stage. And presuming they do get through to a quarterfinal, like we hope and predict they will, at that point they will be moving closer to Paris for their base. But up until the end of next week, I suppose Wednesday or Thursday, when they head on to Paris for that game against Scotland, they'll still be here and still be doing their media duties just outside the... It's a small little city here, but just outside a small little city at a local rugby ground. Not the most glamorous of settings, but the city itself is a lovely place, I have to say, from what I've seen of it so far.
Everybody, or every now and again, we get little bits of insight into what they're up to. So whether it's Peter Romani giving Keith Earls a backer on the bike, or seeing Peter Romani and Conor Murray having a glass of rosé, are they just knocking around? Do you get to see them? Do they interact?
From what I've heard over the last few days, there have been quite a few of them around tour. Mm. A few of the other journalists have hung around for those few days off, and the players have been off spending a bit of time with their families. Some stayed in Paris, some came to tour and just did what they wanted to do for a few days. I only got here yesterday evening, so I've hardly even seen the city itself. I did a quick walk around there yesterday evening and for another 20 minutes at lunchtime. So once I finish filing for the evening, I'll head out and I'll sample what the rest of the city has to offer, and I can get back to you on that.
Please do. It's a working brief. Yeah, you work hard and get the crucial bits of information.
It's for colour. It's for colour, Marie, you know.
So tell me then, just what's the mood like? We've listened to Simon there and he's very much focused on Scotland, what's coming down the track, learnings from South Africa. So it does seem like they're in the zone already.
It does, but in a very relaxed way, I think is a very important way of putting it. And while we've complained a lot over the last couple of years that the Rugby World Cup draw has pitted Ireland in with South Africa and Scotland in this pool of death, the way the games have been laid out has actually fallen quite kindly for Ireland. So, for example, South Africa have it okay as well. Once they get through their final pool game against Tonga this week, they will pretty much have their bye week next week, so they'll have a nice 2-week lead into a quarter final. But it's worked out nicely for Ireland as well, because they have this bye week in between the two toughest games of the pool. So they were able to go after these three matches against Romania, Tonga, and then into South Africa and slowly build their way up and almost play that game against South Africa like it was a mini final or a mini knockout game. And then all of a sudden, they have a week off to rest themselves mentally as much as physically, I would say, after what they had to put into that game against South Africa. And they can head into this game against Scotland now with more than a week's preparation and a few days off in between as well. And even a few players, I don't know, did you mention it at the start there, but Stuart McCluskey, for example, he was one player who was given compassionate leave to come back to Ireland. All the rest of the players stayed in France, but Stuart McCluskey got a couple of days in home. He is back in camp, though. His wife gave birth to their second child in recent days, so he's been able to get home for a couple of days and see the family as well.
Yeah, well, those things are really, really important. And I know as well, there's permutations ahead of this Scotland game, and they look quite complex. There is an article on the RTÉ website. Should I go there and read them, do you think, or are we happy enough that we don't need to worry too much about the permutations?
Oh, go there and read them. To be honest as well, it gives it's too much for me to explain here. No, but it does give a nice breakdown for the rest of the pools as well. But the simple things for Ireland to remember are, and I suppose it gets more simple as well, with all our permutations, we're assuming that Scotland are going to get a bonus point win against Romania this weekend, and we're pretty much assuming that South Africa will do the business against Tonga, and that simplifies things a little bit from an Irish point of view. Pretty much so, if Ireland win against Scotland next week, they are through as the top seed into the quarterfinals, and I think that's the most important one to remember, because Ireland have a good record against Scotland. You shouldn't really be going into a game like this thinking, okay, well, we can lose by fewer than seven or fewer points if we concede three or fewer tries. It is where you start getting into bonus point territory that things become a little bit more complicated. But the important thing for Ireland is win against Scotland next week, and you don't have to worry about any permutations. And if you do want to find out about them, rte.ie/sport. Michael Glennon has gone through them all in great detail.
Okay, well, I like to keep things simple, so I think I'll just stick with going for the win. Neil Tracy, thank you so much. Enjoy whatever you do get up to this evening, sampling the French cuisine and whatever else comes your way. We'll talk to you soon, and thank you for that.
Game on, weeknights from 6.
Now, welcome back. It is time to head to Rome to get a full, comprehensive preview of the Ryder Cup. So let's join Greg Allen, who has assembled some of the best minds in golf. Well, the ones in the press centre anyway.
Thanks, Marie. And you join us here in the media centre on a warm evening in Rome with the matches in the Ryder Cup about to get underway in the morning. And after a lot of pent-up anticipation as to who will be playing who in the opening session of foursomes, we have the pairings. And I have to say, I'm joined, as we are so often at Ryder Cups, by Doug Ferguson, golf writer from Associated Press, and Gary Moran, who will be covering the action with me here in Marco Simeone, just outside Rome. So, Doug Ferguson, USA against Europe. The last match was such an overwhelming one-sided match, and these teams seem more evenly paired this time around. I think roster for roster you can make a case for one team being as strong as the other, with Europe having three of the top four in the world, no American lower than 25th in the world. So let me just go through the pairings that we have. Scottie Scheffler and Sam Burns up against John Rahm and Tyrrell Hatton, first out at 6:35 in the morning Irish time. Then that'll be followed by Max Homa and Brian Harman for the USA against Victor Hovland and Ludwig Aubert for Europe. 7:05 Irish time, Ricky Fowler and Colin Morikawa against Shane Lowry and Sepp Straka. And then at 7:20, Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay against Rory McIlroy and Tommy Fleetwood. First impressions.
They saved the big one for the last, I think, for the spectators. They're all important. Every point matters. But I think, you know, Patrick and Xander have kind of become the identity of a U.S. tandem. They're not flawless, by the way, but they are tough to beat. Rory is Rory, and I think Tommy is, you know, last time we were in Europe and his partnership with Fran, and now he's going against, you know, going with one of Europe's best. I think that match is sensational. And to start off with, really two of the best players of the year. Rory's come on strong late in terms of the world ranking, but Rahm and Scheffler have traded number one so much this year. Neither of them really had a great kind of finish to the year in terms of their quality of play. But from an American side, a lot of eyes are on Scotty. Will he be able to find the hole at any point?
Because of his putting.
His putting, I mean, my goodness, if you looked at what Scotty did up until he got to the green, if he was putting as he did a year ago, he would have a margin at number one in the world that would rival what Tiger was doing back in the day. His ball striking was that good and the putting was that atrocious. He's worked with Phil Kenyon for the last couple of weeks. He's very confident. Everyone's confident in their game, but he was very confident in the direction his work was going. And we get a firsthand look at that right off the bat. It'll be fun.
Yeah, and I think just mentioning Scottie Scheffler, to be world number one, putting as badly as he has putted, and his putting is bad. Let's not varnish it in any sort of way. It's not average. It's just bad. It is extraordinary that he's sending him out straight away, because putting is such an extraordinarily big part of the Ryder Cup.
Foursomes, I think he's going to be. I mean, that's a good fit for him, just because of his striking, because of his driving, because of his iron play. You know, especially around a course like this, there are a lot of, you know, reachable fives and short fours, and some of which are reachable. I still think par's not going to hurt you around here. And so when Scotty misses that four-footer for birdie, I think they'll be okay.
Max Homa and Brian Harman, second match out. Did you see that pairing?
I did not. I forgot Max was on the team. That's a joke.
He's the world number seven.
I think with Morikawa and Harman and Max and even Ricky, I think there was just any kind of possibility of a combination with those. So not terribly surprised. Max has limited experience in terms of how these cups work. Not the format so much, but just the flow of the cups works. That's going to help. And Harman, again, Brian Harman is a guy, as we know him as our Open champion. He's a guy that if he finished 10th or 11th in the standings and no one picked him, no one would probably complain about that. But when he makes your team, no one's worried about it. He's a true, proper, good match play player. And he's got fight and he's got grit. And I think he and Max would be great together. Max has got the attitude, and Brian's got the grit, the fight.
I'm looking at who they're up against, Victor Hovland and Ludvig Åberg, and I think it's a fantastic-looking match in prospect, Homa and Harman against Hovland and Åberg. Not everybody would pick that. I'm going to pick that as the one that I'm most interested in, mainly because Victor Hovland is on a heater right now of extraordinary, I suppose blue heat, white heat, whatever you want to call it. He was the top finisher in the Tour Championship if you just took the 72-hole score, mm-hmm. joint top finisher, won the BMW Championship in the FedEx Cup playoffs, and is just seems to have sorted out the final jigsaw puzzle in his game, which was his chipping and pitching, which he sorted out with his coach Joe Mayo. Victor Hovland looked like he could be world number one in 2 months' time, and Ludvig Åberg could be world number one this time next year. It is an extraordinarily exciting pairing, that Hovland-Åberg pairing, isn't it?
From the marquee level, we talk about the last match in terms of the big names, but in terms of sheer curiosity, I think you nailed it. I think Victor and Ludvig Åberg, chance to pronounce his name properly at some point in my life, is really, really fascinating, because Victor is becoming the complete player, and Åberg to me is maybe might be the most exciting rookie, unless I'm leaving somebody out.
It needs to be remembered that Ludvig made the team having only turned pro 3 months ago. That is a staggering achievement in the modern day of such competitive level of golf, and the players who Europe have left behind not picking, guys like Adrian Morenc, who won the Italian Open around this golf course. So it's a lot of faith in Ludvig.
There really is, and he's the kind of player, when you say the word robot, I think it's got negative connotations. It's just someone who's just mechanical and dull, and there is something about those eyes and that demeanor and that golf swing that is a wonderful kid who just looks like he can take you apart. So yes, winning at Kronzer, magnificent. Leading at Wentworth, bad days happen to everybody, and we've seen it from top to bottom, and there's nothing to lose sleep over that. I'm still intrigued by the idea that Luke would play with him at the John Deere Classic. And I forgot what his score was, but it was something atrocious. It was like a 63 or a 65. To do that in front of the Ryder Cup captain and then go on to finish fourth at the John Deere, all that stuff puts together a package of a kid. And you talk about a heater. That's if you said white hot, we're going to call that blue hot. And if there's engineers out there, please leave me alone.
I'm going to look at the Irish now, because obviously we do, as you know. Shane Lowry and Sepp Straka, I'm going to claim some credit for predicting this. It's not that difficult, because they played together for two rounds in Wentworth. They play the same golf ball, and not one of the most popular golf balls on tour, so it's almost a nice coincidence that they play the same golf ball. And they played 27 holes in practice here. They'll be up against Ricky Fowler and Colin Morikawa. So Sepp and Shane against Fowler and Morikawa. What do you make of that?
Well, I knew Sepp and Shane were coming when I did a piece on Sepp's caddy. He used to be for Kevin Kisner and just was helping Sepp out when they won, and then stayed with him, and here he is at the Ryder Cup. And he told me they played together during that scouting trip at Marco Simone. Luke made sure they played together at Wentworth, and he goes, I suspect we're playing together, and I think they're a good fit. Sepp is a little bit dullish as a player, and I think that's exactly what you want for foursomes. He will not be out of the hole. He won't be out of position very often. And I think that could be a sleeper, as we say in the U.S., foursomes pairing for Europe. I couldn't tell you about the Americans. I always like talking about the Irish, Greg. You know that. Morikawa's, I think his record speaks for itself, especially in foursomes, especially the shape of his shot and the control of his shot, which toward the end of the season would appear to be back. He'd lost some of that. Ricky, to me, is one of the more curious figures on the U.S. team. It's funny, because everybody in America has been talking about JT as this controversial pick. There was nothing controversial about JT. Controversy was Ricky. It took him three Ryder Cups to win his first match. His record overseas has never been any great. He does have his game back, having won in Detroit. I don't know how they're going to blend. I think it'll be interesting. They're both Californians, so we can start there.
And I know we've already spoken about Rory and Tommy against Xander and Patrick. Patrick and Xander have had this record of winning both of their matches together in Whistling Straits, and two out of three in the President's Cup. they're like brothers. They're so close. So that looks like actually a pretty tough ask for Rory and Tommy. Having said that, this is Rory McIlroy and Tommy Fleetwood, and Tommy's in great form, and Rory's in great form.
We all love each other out here, Greg. They're all sportsmen, they're all golfers, but if there's any tension in any match, it could be this one, because I don't see any love lost between Patrick and Rory. And I think that'll be fun. I think they're very professional, and in fact, they were right there together in Memphis. I'm trying to remember the course. I could see them on the green, and there was the obvious great sportsmanship that you would expect, but you know, over other things in golf, as it relates to the Saudi deal and Liv and that whole development, I've sensed a great deal of tension between the two, and I look forward to watching it.
Just elaborate on Patrick and Rory and potential tension.
Their personalities are so different.
Oh yeah, they couldn't be more different.
And I think it's carried over a bit. You know, Patrick is very interesting person. He looks like the grumpiest person on the face of the earth. There's another word for that, but I'm not sure what Irish radio rules are. Rory is a dynamic, exciting, speaks from the heart, and Patrick is super, super measured. He approaches things without bias, which I think is very difficult for anybody to do. Listens to other sides very well, explores things, challenges everything, and I think sometimes when Patrick challenges things, it comes across like he's being a naysayer to everything, and I think it just rubs people the wrong way, and I think Rory's been rubbed the wrong way a few times, and again, I'm talking about tour business, not so much golf. I've always sensed it's kind of spilled over a little bit on the golf side. Now, it's a partnership with Xander, with Tommy, different, and again, when they were in the same group at Memphis, it's fine, but it's the Ryder Cup.
All right, Gary Moran's going to be covering this with me for the next few days. Gary, what are your thoughts on these opening pairings?
I really like the Hovland-Auber game against Homa and Harman from a European point of view. I think Hovland is in amazing form. He actually had a hole-in-one on one of the drivable par fours today.
Yeah, I was there right behind. I was literally right behind. And what happened was that in practice, it was the drivable par four fifth. This is actually significant. We're going to get onto this in a moment about the drivable par fours out there. On the fifth hole, he hit his first shot and it went a bit right. So he just threw a ball down on the tee box, didn't put a tee on it. So from 302 yards, he hit a three wood into the hole from what was a very tight lie. And it just showed to some degree the talent of Victor Hovland. And a big cheer went up, biggest cheer of the practice days. And my goodness, do practice days need cheers sometimes? They can be long and a bit tedious. But anyway, Gary, moving on.
I mean, I'm not hanging it on that one shot, but so that doesn't suggest one shot doesn't mean he's in great form, but it's an amazing thing all the same. But I think Auber, his game is perfect for here. Long straight drives, he's lots of qualities, but long straight driving is one of his chief qualities. And I would take them to, of all the four games, I take them over Homa Harman if I had to pick one as a. It's not a nailed on winner, of course it's not. No 18 hole game at this level is a nailed on winner, but I really fancy them. McIlroy, Fleetwood, Schauffele, Cantlay, very interesting game, as you've mentioned already. Interesting to see, I mean, it's hard to pick a likely winner. Larry Straka v Fowler, Morikawa, and that first game as well. Big game too. Ram Hatton against Scheffler Burns. Very hard to call that one. There's interest as well, I think, in the players who've been left out. If we've time to look at that briefly, like you've Matt Fitzpatrick, Justin Rose, Bob McIntyre and Rasmus Højgaard for Europe, and Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Brooks Koepka, Wyndham Clark for the States. I mean, I'd be thinking that I would be... I don't know. I think Zach Johnson will play everybody on day one, and the two obvious pairings in the afternoon, Spieth and Thomas, and Koepka, the kind of big beast, to take Clark, the rookie, under his wing. I have a feeling that Donald will play the other four as well. I'm not quite sure in what combination. Could be Fitzpatrick, Rose, but then you're leaving two rookies, McIntyre, Højgaard, so they may split one each out of those four. But then, of course, the question is who won't play and how much do you take form in the morning? He's got to make the call before the morning games are over, so it's a tough for a captain. The captain's speeches were fantastic. The two speeches in the opening ceremony, I mean, they were well pitched. They were emotional. Luke Donald said it is the highlight of his career, and he's been a world number one. They called for the loudest Ryder Cup ever, but they were very respectful of both teams, called for respect for the traditions of the game. You don't want any of this ridiculous nonsense of people shouting when players are going to play putts, especially if they got some silly bet on a 2-1 that some team wins the hole. We do not want any of that. I mean, I'm kind of old and a traditionalist, but that is just absolute nonsense. But it should be really loud. I mean, the crowds even today and tomorrow is going to be just up like 10 levels. I'm really looking forward to it, and I think it's a very interesting set of four opening games.
Yeah, I think it was a score draw in the speeches, and they may have been the best two speeches in the Ryder Cup. I don't know if that's down to something, Doug. I thought the matches in Whistling Straits, not saying that marked a low in the Ryder Cup, because the Americans beat the Europeans fair and square with a much better team. But there have been four consecutive matches since the miracle at Medina in 2012, which have been one-sided. I think the average winning score is 7 points for if you go over those four matches, 2014 for Europe and Gleneagles, 2016 for America and Hazeltine, 2018 for Europe in Paris, and 2021 in Whistling Straits. And I'm not saying that the Ryder Cup is in any sort of decline. All you have to do is look at the corporate hospitality building around here, which is 30% more than it was in Paris. And that in itself was 20% more than it was in Gleneagles. It is just a huge event, the biggest thing I've ever seen in 30 years covering in majors. I just think, though, the Ryder Cup needs something, and it needs a tight match. This has all the makings of a tight match, but I can see you wincing just as Rory McIlroy winced when I said it to him that this Ryder Cup needs a tight match. And he said, no, I think if we win like we won in Paris, that'll be fine. What do you think?
I talked to Rory about this at Eastlake actually a couple of weeks ago, and he made a fair point. I mean, we do talk about how it switched home and home, but he also said it hasn't really been close. You know, Americans win big at Hazeltine and Whistling Straits, and then you've got Paris and Gleneagles, I think his point was that was showing the value of home. He thought the home course was underrated. Everybody understands the crowd, but we are due. I mean, Medina, Wales, is it okay?
They were close. They were really close. Yeah.
Is it okay if we skip Ireland? We
can skip. No, you don't want to remember 2006 or 2004 in Detroit.
I would say honestly, and this doesn't get talked about enough, but when we talk about the modern era of Europe, of the Ryder Cup, it starts in 1979 when the continent was invited. When we talk about the modern era of the U.S., to me it starts in 2008 with Paul Azinger, because the U.S., and again, this never gets talked about enough, they had the most antiquated system to qualify for the team. It was based on top tens, and you had this huge international influx of players from Europe, from Asia, from Africa. And getting a top 10 was hard. And it was willy-nilly who we were getting on the team. So I like to look at everything. I love the K-Club. Everything from 2008 forward. And that's kind of what we had. I am in favor of a close match. And I would say one other thing about the crowd, what I've noticed over the years, is I think people are attracted by nature to negativity, to negative comments directed. And when you've got a small crowd and you've got one or two or three comments, and they stand out, when you have tenfold the size of the crowd, you're going to get tenfold the amount of comments, and it seems like they're more and more and more. I think there's always been a degree of negativity, and the bigger the crowds get, I think the worse it's going to get. I'd be in favor of the organizers of just reducing the crowd a little bit and making the experience better for all.
Okay, I'm going to talk about the golf course, and I'll give my own Tupplesworth first. I think the golf course is good for Ryder Cup. I don't think it's a golf course that'll ever go down as a classic golf course. But then again, how many Ryder Cup courses do? You know, it's a statement of...
Valhalla.
Yes, Valhalla, yes. We won't go into any detail about that. But they're all, you know, scenarios where money has exchanged hands and the right to host the Ryder Cup is bigger than simply, you know, playing it on a classic old golf course. It's about the tourism element that it brings to a country, and a lot of that is about playing a golf course on what is effectively a resort course or a resort style course that we have here. But I think it's a good golf course. Very serious in undulation in the land in terms of the Ryder Cup. Drivable par fours, the fifth and the 16th playing as drivable par fours today. On and two par fives, but with lots of risk and reward. Par threes, which could be won with par. It's certainly in foursomes. What do you make of it so far as a golf course to stage it on? Because we're in Italy. It's the first time we're in, you know, this part of the world for a Ryder Cup. And is it going to be a big deal for Italy to have this showcased as their golf presentation?
It is. And the course is fine. And they're all fine. And a minute ago, I quipped about Valhalla, and I'm about to praise it. You spoke well about the golf course and what kind of a test that it's going to present to the players. But to me, what makes the Ryder Cup is the cheering and the sound and the volume. And to me, that's what this golf course delivers. With the number of holes that intersect and cross and the number of people that can be there, and not just on your hole, you could hear and figure out what's going on immediately next to you. Whistling Straits, we had this big body of water on one side of the fairway, I think, that made it a little bit difficult at times. That's to me what stands out of Marco Simone. And here we are going to Oakland Hills one year in the U.S., and they're going to Bethpage, huge mistake next time, by the way, in 2025, these big championship courses. But to me, Valhalla was one of the best courses. It doesn't matter if it goes down in history as one of the classics or if it could ever host multiple majors without the PGA of America owning it. It matters to do with what kind of experience do you have for the fans who are going to be bringing the cheering and the noise and lifting up the players, which to me just gives this massive wave toward great shots. That to me is what I like about Marco Simone, equal to some of the shots it presents.
And I'll say one thing about this golf course, because it's so undulating, it's got a lot of hills built up on the side of fairways and greens, so you've got fantastic vantage points for spectators. So there's going to be a lot of spectators with a clear view of the action. Gary, you were out there today watching the Junior Ryder Cup, and obviously there were lots of crowds watching that because they're here as well to watch the players practice. What was it like?
The galleries following the Junior Ryder Cup weren't massive for sure. There were plenty of other people just milling around and either in hospitality or in Tented Village or just doing whatever they wanted to do. There wasn't a huge amount. I was with the Sean Keeling game for his front nine holes, and what a great Junior Ryder Cup he had. But what I do agree with Doug with and with yourself, the changes in elevation, the amount of vantage points is a big asset for crowds to be able to see more than they would on a flatter course. And big undulations on fairways, if you catch a particular downslope, you'll get a big extra run. And then the danger around some of the greens, water close to some of the greens, big fall-offs. If you come up 1 or 2 yards short on one of the par threes, you're going to roll way back down. If you go too far, you're facing a really difficult chip or putt back. So there's a lot of precision needed for those. So it's a course with fine margins. If you're attacking, there are very fine margins, and obviously in match play there are times when you really have to put the foot down, perhaps more so than in stroke play.
And just to actually recall the Junior Ryder Cup, Europe won the Junior Ryder Cup today by 20.5 points to 9.5. First time they've won since it was staged in Ireland back in 2006, and Sean Keeling a part of that team from Rogenstown in Swords. Just in general, Gary, your impressions of what is facing Europe with this heavy defeat last time out in Whistling Straits. And it was, you know, almost humbling. But that was a team that was in transition. This is a team that looks fully formed, this European team.
It was a team that was in transition. There was very few European fans there. There was somewhat hostile US fans. Not outrageous, perhaps, but certainly very vociferous in support of the USA team. Because of COVID, as I said, so few Europeans. I'm certainly not fearful for Europe. If I had to call it, and I said this yesterday on the show, I would make Europe very marginal favourites. I expect a very close game. I know the USA are rated by most people as marginal favourites, so I do expect it to be very close. I don't see anything for Europe to fear, to be perfectly honest about it.
Doug, your own sense, and we're all trying to wave flags to some degree, but you're a very sit-and-defence sort of character, aren't you?
I would just like to say, for starters, if you can call Scottie Scheffler's putting bad, Gary, there's no reason you can't call the US crowd atrocious. You have my complete blessing.
I wasn't there, so you were both.
I was there, and it wasn't great. And what was most disappointing in Whistling Straits was the wives and girlfriends of the players felt a bit intimidated by the crowd, and that's something that has now been well expressed by not just them, but by, you know, some of the players.
It's getting vulgar. I think that's what's troubling me a little bit over there.
Is that a problem possibly that could raise its head here? Do you think?
No, not in Italy. I just think it's an American thing. Wish I could disguise my accent, but I really think that's what it is. But
just before we go into, you know, what you might think would happen, why do you think that is?
Media, not us, of course. I think social media is what I mean. I think everyone having such a voice and such an anonymous voice to just say whatever they want and try and wind people up on pick your platform. I mean, whether it's TikTok or Twitter or X or what some people call face chat, which the ones who don't know anything about social media. But I just think there's so many avenues to say so many things, and it just has become, it's just getting unruly. But I hope it doesn't. I think it was bad at Hazeltine, and I think it was worse at Whistling Straits. And to my point, I think that's just because the crowd was so one-sided given the travel restrictions from COVID. So, I've never a problem anywhere in Europe that I've ever experienced.
So this week, this weekend, this next 3 days, what way do you see it going?
Well, I never know anything, Greg, but I honestly think every time
That's why we've had you on for the last 13 years since Celtic Manor.
I honestly think every time I come over here, I seem to think this might be the year the Americans win, and they never do. And this is the one time I feel very, very strongly about Europe. So I would think America's probably going to win.
And I'm going to call it a draw, because I just want to see that argument all over again as to whether we should have a shootout for the last match on the course in singles. Because I was at the Solheim Cup last week. I got completely why the Americans felt that they should have some sort of way of winning the match, because in the circumstances, they were 4-0 up after the foursomes and Europe made a great comeback. Both teams were heroic in how they played, and to go away with a draw seemed, to be honest, a good result. But I could see also why there was this sense that there should be a deciding factor.
I don't. I just think it's modern again. Social media and avenues to discuss, and all of a sudden we've got to change everything, and we've got to change almost a century of history. We can't have a tie. What I find interesting, if all these, and it's again, it's mostly fans who are just chattering. That includes journalists, by the way, mostly from the U.S. But the one person that hasn't weighed in on this, which I put in a request, is Jack Nicklaus. There's been two significant ties, and Jack was involved in both of them.
Yeah.
And so one of the most celebrated moments in the Ryder Cup was Jack Nicklaus making sure they had a tie. And now we're trying to get rid of it. And the other one was the President's Cup in South Africa, which for those of us who were there, was the absolute right thing to do, and it just felt like the right thing to do, and it was a good decision. And I want to hear what Jack has to say.
Yeah, you know, this goes back to Jack Nicklaus in 1969 in the Ryder Cup match at Royal Birkdale, where he conceded Tony Jacklin a 2-foot putt, and it ended up in a draw. The United States retained the trophy as a result of it, but it was a moment which has gone down in history and has been remembered for the last 54 years. So I'm calling it a draw anyway, and you're going to call it for an America, and Gary doesn't see anything to fear in terms of a European victory.
I don't mind if it's I don't mind what the result is. I don't mind if it is a tie. The thing that grated slightly in Finca Cortesina for the Solheim was "We are the champions" being celebrated on the stage. I don't think that was right. It should be an honourable draw. Okay, so you retain it, so you don't have to hand over the cup, but it's a draw.
Well, you're calling a win for Europe. Doug's calling an American win, probably both marginal. I think it's so marginal that it could well be, I'm not joking, it could well be 14-14 come the singles on Sunday. What I think is most important is that it's close, because we need a close Ryder Cup, an exciting Ryder Cup. They're all exciting, I suppose, as Rory McIlroy says, even if it's 19-9 to the Americans or a big win for Europe in Paris as it was. But a really exciting Medina-like, Celtic Manor-like Ryder Cup would do us all a ton of good here. Doug Ferguson, Associated Press. Gary Moore, who'll be with me over the weekend covering the Ryder Cup. Thanks for joining us. Back to you, Marie.
Thanks, Greg. Very comprehensive preview of the Ryder Cup, no doubt. Loads of people will be taking the weekend off, sitting down, chilling out, watching the Ryder Cup does attract huge numbers. Keith Tracy is with me here in studio. Will you sit around now and watch that for the weekend?
I will. I'll sit around maybe when it gets to the last day or so, when it starts getting a little bit more exciting. But I do like golf. I wouldn't be an avid watcher of it, but the Ryder Cup usually gets me interested, yeah.
We were talking yesterday with Greg about Gareth Bale and his ability and whether or not he could go on someday and actually make a tour player. We figured out that he probably wouldn't be at that level, but it was interesting to hear about former footballers getting into golf. Was it something that was on your radar when you were playing?
It was on my radar, yeah, because when I played for Preston and Burnley, I lived in Lytham, and anybody who likes a game of golf will know that Lytham St Anne's is a lovely place to play golf. So I lived there, and to be honest with you, I used golf as a bit of an avenue to sneak into the back door of the pub, so I would go and play. I think my wife actually still thinks there's 19 holes on a golf course, so yeah, no, I did. For my mental health, I used to go around and have a little game of golf by myself, 4 hours, just wandering around, having a little, I'm absolutely bang average at it, to be honest with you. I'm cack-handed, but I don't play for any sort of, you know, trying to improve or anything like that. I just, for the social side of it and the mental health.
All right, that's quite an interesting one. All right, you must have a bit of time to be able to go and do that.
I did when I was a footballer. Very, very rare now. Yeah, I got that time on my hands.
Okay, that's good to hear, though. Oh, we're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be talking football with Keith. And we're also going to hear from Jeff Shepherd all the way stateside.
RTE
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. I'm delighted to say that Keith Tracy is still with me here in studio. We're going to have a look back at some of those Carabao Cup games from last night. Keith, the name on everyone's lips is Andrew Moore, and he's so impressive for Blackburn last night when they beat Cardiff 5-2, two goals and an assist as well. How much potential does this guy have?
Bags full of potential, Marie. Really, really good player. I watched the game last night. He was outstanding. His second goal, he can really, is a good smack of a ball with his right foot. His assist, the way to pass for the ball through was really, really good. And we always end up looking at these players with Irish eyes, obviously, and we're thinking, could he fit into our Irish force team? And on paper, he looks absolutely ideal, but he is only 19 years old. He's only played a handful of games in the Championship. He's on loan from Brighton, so this boy is just going to get better and better. When you think of De Zerbi and Jan Dahl Thomason now, who's the manager of Blackburn. You know, Thomason is a legend in the game, a legend of a player. He will know the right avenue for Andrew Morden to be going down, and he's going from strength to strength. And when I think of Andrew Morden, the first thing that pops into my head is that goal against Turkey for the under-21s, a brilliant strike. So he looks to have all the technical ability in the world, can see a pass, and all of a sudden you start thinking of Evan Ferguson, Ogbeni, Aaron Connolly, Morden, these players that up the top of the pitch we look like we're getting better and better. So looks like a match made in heaven to come into the Irish force team at some point. But again, I hate heaping praise on young players too easy, because I do feel like I've been in this I've had this a bit in my past, and it does weigh down your shoulders. But look, at the minute, absolutely brilliant, and he does seem to have that bit of class that we all want from an Irish attacking player.
The good thing is, though, if there's a few players and we're heaping praise and pressure on all of them, then it spreads out a bit. And we have got a few players now that we can look to and think, right, well, they could carry that green jersey into the future.
Yeah, there is so many. Even Mark McGuinness scored the other day as well, a centre-half. So there is some people coming through from at the back end of the pitch as well. But all over, it does look like they're coming through. But again, you know, international football is such a step up, even for Championship players, League One, even Premiership players that have never played international football. It's such a step up. It's just different, Marie. It's more of a tactical battle. It's not really about, you know, running around. That obviously is a big part of it, but it's more of a tactical battle when you play international football or competitive international football. So the question mark would still be out over these boys, but, you know, from the outside looking in, they look really, really good.
And I think especially from the point of view of him taking the opportunity, because loan moves don't always work out, but it seems that he has his head screwed on and he's seeing this as an opportunity, Andrew Moran.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, sometimes I've been in a Premiership club. It was actually at Blackburn Rovers, and I had to take a step back to Sheffield United, and it's very easy to view that as, oh, this is a step backwards, the manager doesn't like me, I'm being sent out. And I'm sure De Zerbi has not painted that picture to Andrew Moran, but sometimes as a player you think a little bit differently. But he's really took the bull by the horns, and the Championship is a very, very good level to be playing at 19 years of age, and he looks really, really comfortable out on the right wing forward. And even his first goal last night, he goes and wins the ball in the press, which is really, really encouraging for us as well, because we know we want to be a front foot pressing team. So yeah, not just technical ability, not just a good strike, good pass to the ball, he actually run around and win the ball back for his, you know, both sides of the games.
Do you have a take on Caoimhín Kelleher and whether or not he's doing the right thing staying with Liverpool? He captained the side last night, and there's lovely pictures of him and Klopp afterwards, and you can see that he's in a really positive environment, but he's not playing that much.
No, he's not. And I was reading the paper the other day, and he had Shea Given's stats up next to Caoimhín's stats at Caoimhín's age right now. And obviously Shea had played nearly 150 games in the Premier League, had so many caps for Ireland. And when you think of Caoimhín being as talented as he is, it must grate on him not being the Irish number one. But look, he's in it. He's not playing at Liverpool. He's getting the odd game here and there. But when you look at his CV, Champions League games, he's winning Premier Leagues. Although he's not at the forefront of it, it's still a brilliant place to be as a player. I know he's not playing week in, week out, but he's a goalkeeper. He could probably play till he's 40 if he looks after himself. So Look, it doesn't have to happen straight away for Quivey, and I think he's in a brilliant environment. He's learning under one of the best managers in the world, and his talent is probably working against him, the fact that Jurgen Klopp has said he's the best number two in the world and he doesn't want to see him go, so that may work against him. But I don't see any rush. I know it's grating on him, he wants to get caps, he feels that he's getting older all the time, which he is, but yeah, he is in Alisson's shadow at the minute, but there's no rush. I know he wants games, but I don't think there's any rush. I can see really both sides of this one.
Yeah, it's a real tricky one, but when you get to see him, like, you know, it's only the Carabao Cup, but still, you know, it's a big enough stage, like a lot of people are watching him. He got to wear the captain's armband, and that there, the opportunities do come along. It just needs to come along more frequently.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that Jurgen Klopp has given him the captain's armband, I think that's another one that he's like a little pat on the back. Well done for staying around. Your standards are staying high. Even though you're not going to play in the Premier League, you're still putting it in. And I think that was just a genuine tap on the back. Well done, Quivey. Yeah. I still love you and the club loves you. But in terms of actually getting in and playing in the Premier League, I don't think it'll be happening anytime soon for him.
Yeah, it is hard, all right. And Newcastle beat Manchester City last night. Were you impressed with their performance?
Really impressed, yeah. Obviously, Manchester City in the first half were, I don't want to say dominant, because, you know, having the ball doesn't mean you're dominating the game. They had the lion's share of the ball, but Newcastle in the second half, Isak in particular, I know he went off injured, but Tonali, loved Tonali in the middle. And Newcastle just seemed to have this ability to steamroll people in St James's Park. There was a 5 or 10 minute period where they were even steamrolling Manchester City. And I know it's not the Manchester City starting 11, but there is some seriously talented international players in that Manchester City team. But Newcastle, once the crowd gets behind them and they start building up ahead of steam, it's so, so hard to stop it up in St James's.
Yeah, Eddie Howe just seems to know exactly what he wants to do with his team. I don't know, can you say the same about Pochettino and Chelsea? They did get a win last night.
They did get a win, but like, from Pochettino, if you're walking into a room and you're trying to crack the whip, you're trying to get the lads motivated, you know, say for instance somebody needs a little bit of a kick up the backside, if it's Mudrick for example, these lads that are coming in the door have 7 and 8 year deals. They're going to be there for longer than Pochettino's going to be there, in all likeliness. So for Pochettino to be talking about players or trying to motivate these players that are on 7 or 8 year contracts, I just think it's a highway to nothing to be able to try and motivate these boys. So I think the model that Chelsea have gone down, I know it's because of the FIFA fair play rules, but I just don't see it ending well there at all.
Me either. We'll be keeping an eye on that, no doubt. We're going to cross stateside now and join Jeff Shepherd. Shep, I wanted to talk to you about the Dolphins scoring 70 points, the highest most points scored by any team in the NFL since 1966. But I'm going to start by asking you about Taylor Swift and the effect that she had on... on Travis Kelce, I guess.
Well, I mean, he was a good football player before. You know, those of us who follow the world of sports, we know who he is. Look, I got a lot of non-football people in my life that are now all very interested in the Chiefs all of a sudden that are asking me questions. And I refuse to participate. I refuse. No, I mean, look, obviously, Marie, the Chiefs, played the late afternoon game here in America on Sunday, and right before the game started, they showed the Kelce suite at the stadium, and sitting next to Travis and Jason Kelce's mom is Taylor Swift. And so it has just been chaos for the last 4 days between, you know, the crossover between the NFL and the Swifties, you know, so it's just been unbelievable.
My husband was given out. He was like, why are they asking Patrick Mahomes about Taylor Swift? He was like, you know, he's a footballer. Like, we need to be talking football with him. He couldn't get his head around it.
Yes. So he said Travis Kelce kind of alluded to it maybe Friday or Saturday. And then all of a sudden he's like, yeah, no, I think she's actually going to be here. And, you know, I mean, just the security that was involved. They had a post-game party where they shut down this restaurant and she went there with him. And so, you know, he sort of addressed it a little bit. You know, he has a podcast with his brother who plays for the Philadelphia Eagles. And he addressed it a little bit. And it sounds like they're, you know, Marie, young love is just so, it's so wonderful to see. And it sounds like, you know, they're just starting to kind of, you know, figure out what is this a thing or what's going on. So there's been all these rumors the last couple of weeks, and then all of a sudden she shows up at the game on Sunday. And again, it's just been all downhill from there.
Now, you say young love. He's like hitting for his mid-30s now. You think he'd have a bit more sense. But then again, he did have a dating show called Catching Kelsey, where he was the actual catch.
Yes, so, and she's a billionaire. So
she's
like,
a billionaire,
I'm fine,
yeah.
You know. Right, you know, he's smart. He's a big football player. That doesn't mean he's dumb. You know, he's smart. And so now, look, I just hope he understands what this means. I mean, she's going to write a song about him at some point. You know, yeah. And I mean, what do we think it's called? I mean, not that tight of an end, you know, crossing routes, something like that. I mean, the puns, that you know, they just write themselves, Marie, but
has the Super Bowl act for this year been, for the next season, this season been announced yet?
Yes, it's going to be Usher, but okay. Who knows? Maybe she comes in and look, what happens if they don't make it to the Super Bowl? Now that's a whole other thing. She's tearing the team apart,
there you go.
Know?
Yeah. There is a lot to play out in this situation, that's for sure. Thank you so much, as always, Shep. We'll talk to you next week. Keith, thank you very much for coming in. Are you an American football fan?
A little bit, yeah. I like the Super Bowl.
Yeah, okay, cool. Right, so you've golf, bit of Super Bowl, bit of Taylor Swift?
Well, I've two young girls, so a little bit more than I'd like, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not sure if Beto Da Silva is going to play Taylor Swift, but he's up next.
RTE 2FM.